Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
More than six decades after the landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision in Brown v. Board of Education outlawed state-mandated segregation, race remains a factor in how Texas students are educated. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. And today, as part of KERA's American Graduate Project, Race, Poverty, and the Changing Face of Schools, we're partnering with the folks at Houston Public Media to take a broad look at how changing demographics are shaping education. Craig Cohen joins us today. He is host of Houston Matters. Craig, it's great to have you with us on Think.
Hi, Chris. Great to be with you here today as part of Houston Public Media's year-long Diverse City Project. This hour, we're going to talk about the challenges and opportunities created by school populations that have shifted in a number of ways, from mostly white to more diverse, and in urban districts, from middle class to mostly lower income.
In a few minutes, KERA reporter Stella Chavez will join me to talk about how a high school in Frisco is making sure that students from diverse backgrounds feel welcome. First up this hour, Craig, you're joined by one of your Houston colleagues.
Houston Public Media News 88.7 education reporter Laura Eisensee is following developments at Fur High School as it implements a $10 million grant that aims to, in essence, shake up the traditional high school model. The East Houston School received the grant back in November from the XQ Institute, led by Laureen Powell Jobs, the widow of Apple co-founder Steve Jobs. Fur is just one of 10 in the country to receive the five-year award. In the latest installment of her series, Laura is looking at the leadership at Fur High School and how significantly that leadership has been in spurring drastic changes for the school. She joins us now. What prompted you to look into Fur High School?
Here on the beat in Houston, I'd heard different things about Fur pop up. I mean, the principal in general, when I saw her at press conferences, she just seemed like a really interesting character. It's not very often that you see a principal in her 70s or 80s leading a high school. And then we got this news that Fur had won this really big grant from XQ Institute. And I was curious to go behind the scenes and really delve into what are they trying to do? Who are the students? Who are the teachers? How is the principal leading this charge with the whole backstory of Fur, you know, of other troubles and transformations that they've had?
What are the biggest challenges this high school is facing?
From talking with the principal, Dr. Bertie Simmons, I think she would say the biggest challenge is poverty. When you look at health, education, opportunities for jobs, it's one of the poorest areas in the entire country. It ranks number 8th from the bottom in the entire country. So I think the biggest challenge are those challenges that come with poverty, and also trying to prepare students not just to pass a standardized exam and say that they can write an essay for the state to pass and graduate from high school, but to really develop critical thinkers, problem solvers.
For today's story, you focused on the importance of school leadership. Why?
Well, to start off with, Bertie Simmons is a fascinating person. It's not many people who come out of retirement and take on a difficult high school, much less spend 17 years there, and now she's keeping on going with this new project. But also, I was really intrigued with this idea of if you're taking on a really big challenge, if you're trying to innovate, how much does that leadership matter? That's why I wanted to look at Bertie Simmons with this project.
And Simmons has largely been credited with the changes that are going on at Fur High School. I understand that part of her philosophy is rooted in an incident that happened to her in childhood.
Yes, she told me about this story because I kept asking, why are you still here at Fur? Dr. Simmons said she grew up in northern Louisiana and she grew up poor. And her best friend was Dorothy. And one day they got a quarter and they thought, we're going to go get ice cream. Bertie could only go to the front of the store, and Dorothy had to get ice cream from the back of the store.
These were back in the old Jim Crow days.
Yes, this is in the 1940s when we had a segregated society. And on their way home, they pass a water fountain. Bertie says, well, I'm going to drink from the same water fountain that you drink from. And she did. Later, Bertie found out that violating those Jim Crow laws had real consequences for Dorothy's family. Dorothy came to her house and said, I have to go right away. My family has to move. Later that night, a group of men burned Dorothy's home down. And Bertie was extremely upset. She didn't understand why. She asked her mother about it. And this is what she told me.
And so I said to my mother later, did I cause her house to burn down? And she said, probably, because I drank from the wrong fountain. And she said, probably, but I want you to remember, regardless, you always do the right thing for all people. And so I made a commitment then that I was going to be devoted the rest of my life to being sure that things like that didn't happen to people again.
That's Bertie Simmons, principal at Furr High School. We're talking with Houston Public Media education reporter Laura Eisensee. How has Bertie Simmons been instrumental in making changes at Furr since she took the helm 17 years ago?
She's done quite a bit already. This project with transforming high school is just one example, but I talked with some students and teachers, and I think one takeaway is that she really lets people be creative.
Let's hear what one teacher, Juan Elizondo, says about the changes he's seen with his students.
What I see is that they have a purpose, you know, and before in our community, people would say, go ahead and leave because there's nothing here. There's no experiences to gain. But here at Furr, we're able to cultivate the next leaders for the city of Houston, homegrown leaders.
That's teacher Juan Elizondo. We're talking with Laura Eisensee. What other stories are you pursuing for this series?
Well, I really want to follow along with the different changes that Dr. Simmons and the team at Furr implement. One goal that they have is to have a mentor for every single kid. And that's something they're going to be starting in the fall. Also, they're going to be getting a new building, potentially with a new health clinic and a center for newcomer immigrant students. And then just overall, how do you personalize learning? How do you bring learning to the 21st century? And what does it mean for this community in Houston's East End that, again, faces a lot of challenges with poverty and jobs? In the fall, Furr High School is going to be relaunching their entire freshman experience. And so that's something that I'll be really delving into later on as we get further in the fall.
Laura Eisensee is News 88.7's education reporter. Laura, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Chris.
Thanks, Craig. The city of Frisco has transformed over the last quarter century from a country town to a booming suburb that's home to high-end shops and the Dallas Cowboys. Its schools have been transformed, too. KERA education reporter Stella Chavez looks at how one school, Liberty High, is changing.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
It's Friday, a little after 2 at Liberty High School. Zaki Sayed recites the Islamic call to prayer. He and 10 other Muslim students are inside a classroom, on their knees, facing northeast. Girls wear hijabs. Everyone's taken off their shoes. They spend the next 15 minutes in prayer. This is not a common scene at most schools. At Liberty, it happens every Friday. Frisco, once a small railroad town, is now one of the fastest growing cities in the country. 2 decades ago, 3 out of every 4 people living here were white. Today, it's a fusion of races and ethnicities. And schools are a microcosm of that. At Liberty, fewer than half of the students are white. 30% are Asian.
My full name is Divya Priya Murali. I'm a junior and I'm 17 years old.
Divya was born in Mesquite. Her parents are from the southern Indian state of Tamil Nadu. It's known for majestic Hindu temples. Even though she was born here, Divya embraces her Indian roots. She celebrates Diwali and goes to the Hindu version of Sunday school. But when it comes to Tamil, the language spoken in southern India, well...
When I was younger, like in elementary school, my parents took me to like a Tamil school that they had running here, and I hated it. But like, I can understand Tamil, but my American accent is like... so strong, you can't really understand my Tamil.
She's also learned some Hindi. This cultural curiosity is what fuels her and the weekly podcast she produces.
Hey there, Redhawks. I'm Divya Murali, and this is the 19th episode of the United Colors of Liberty. And today, I'm here with senior Lizzie Bernius.
Every week, Divya goes in depth with a different student. There's an Indian who's Christian, a kid who's lesbian with interracial parents, and a black student who doesn't celebrate Kwanzaa. Sometimes current headlines spark an idea, like when she interviewed Russian-born classmate Sasha Chuprakova.
How do you feel about there may potentially be more of a intense hostility between the countries?
I don't think it would get to the same point it was at the Cold War, because again...
Lately, Divya's been thinking about the shooting of 2 Indian men in suburban Kansas. One was killed. The accused shooter is white, and before he was arrested, he said he thought they were Middle Eastern.
What happened in Kansas was truly a tragedy, especially since the Indian man and his friend that were killed, that could have easily been one of my relatives, my dad, like someone close to me.
Brian Higgins teaches journalism to Divya and her classmates.
Hopefully they're hearing something that they maybe never thought of before. And if we can get one student to think differently or to perhaps better understand the diversity and the different people and their backgrounds on this campus, then I think we've done a good job.
Higgins came from a very different school, Lovejoy. It's affluent and about 85% white. He says being in a more diverse school gives kids the chance to explore a more challenging range of issues. Take Megan Lin. She's Chinese, a sophomore, and just wrote a column about Asian stereotypes. She says it bugs her when people assume all Asian students are overachievers.
Some people think it's a good stereotype to be stereotyped as a smart person, but for those people, when they're expected to be smart and, you know, they feel inadequate, they feel like they're ashamed to their culture, and I don't think that that's right.
Sometimes changes in a student body force a school to change too. 8 years ago, there was no prayer room at Liberty. Scott Worsler is the principal.
We had a group of Muslim students who were leaving school on Fridays for Friday prayer. Parents would come pick them up, and what we found was they were missing about 2 hours of class because of the commute.
At one point, 30 students were leaving campus to pray at a Plano mosque every Friday. Eventually, Liberty let them use an empty classroom as a prayer room.
They're not out proselytizing. They're not out in the lunch periods. If others wanted to go in and learn and experience that, our students are okay with that.
Learning more about each other was the point last year when then-senior Jay Schlegel organized a forum on religious diversity at Liberty. At the time, Schlegel was president of Liberty's Bible study group. And that night, he shared the stage with presidents of the Muslim and Hindu student associations.
With Islamic radicalism around the globe, you have people in Frisco, Texas that are being talked about in ways that it's an unrelated thing. And I can't agree with that. I think that that's an ignorance of people that you've been neighbors with for years.
And Stella Chavez joins me now in the studio. Stella, you talked to a diverse group of students at Liberty High School. Did you get a sense that the students there are conscious of the diversity around them, or are they so used to it that it almost doesn't register?
Yeah, a lot of students I talked to said they don't really think about it or talk about the diversity very much for them, especially the ones who've grown up in Frisco. They've grown up with people of diverse backgrounds, so it's very normal for them. But when you press some students for more specific information, I think there are some students who have had negative experiences, whether it's in the city, you know, in the community, or family members have experienced things. So it's not like they're not aware of some of the issues or challenges that come with diversity. So if you ask them, you know, for more specific information, they'll tell you either experience they've had or their family members have had.
You are also looking at O.D. Wyatt High School in Fort Worth, and this is a school that has gone from being predominantly white when it opened in the late 60s to more than 90% African American in the 90s. Today, more than half its students are Hispanic. Are these demographic shifts leading to any changes in how students are actually taught?
I think so. What I've noticed is that, first of all, that school, O.D. Wyatt, has a new principal this year who is really trying to improve the morale of students. And he wants, you know, for many years, this school has struggled academically. And so he's trying to get students to think more positive about themselves and to encourage them to do well. So he's really trying to challenge the students to think about themselves differently. And so that just because it's a school that is largely minority, it doesn't have to suffer academically.
Stella, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Chris.
When we return, we'll talk with H. Richard Milner of the University of Pennsylvania, who helps educators understand how race and poverty affect their students' experiences in the classroom.
And we'll talk with Linda McNeil of the Rice University Center for Education about how Houston and Texas schools are changing with the changing demographics.
That's when our special edition of Think continues.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd.
And I'm Craig Cohen, host of Houston Matters.
Today, our shows are partnering up for a special conversation about diversity, opportunity, and Texas schools. We'll begin taking your calls in a few minutes at 800-933-5372, or you can email your questions and comments to think@kera.org. It's all part of KERA's American Graduate Series, Race, Poverty, and the Changing Face of Schools.
And Houston Public Media's year-long Diverse City Project. In a few minutes, I'll talk with Linda McNeil of the Rice University Center for Education about the challenges that Houston and Texas educators are facing as demographics and funding opportunities change.
But right now we're joined by H. Richard Milner, professor of education at the University of Pittsburgh and director of the Center for Urban Education. Rich, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
We've heard earlier in the program about schools with very diverse populations. Is it going too far to say, though, that a lot of other American schools are unofficially segregated these days?
I think what we found is overwhelmingly schools are resegregating. And when you look at schools that are, quote unquote, racially diverse, what we see is that there's actually a good deal of segregation within the schools. So when you think about issues of tracking, students of color tend to take classes together, and those classes that might be considered advanced or accelerated, those students are typically white and middle class.
And that may not have to do, I'm hearing in the subtext, that may not necessarily have to do with how capable the students are of succeeding in those classes.
Absolutely. I think what we find is that students are successful across different demography when mechanisms are in place to support them. So our big challenge in education is really to build the skills and build the capacity to be supportive of students regardless of their race, their socioeconomic status, their gender, their sexual orientation. We've got to be more responsive as an educational system to respond to the humanity of those students.
What challenges do students of color face in school at higher rates than their white peers?
One of the biggest challenges we face is, especially for students of color, is disproportionate office referrals, which consequently lead to suspensions and expulsions. So, for instance, what we find is that teachers tend to have good intentions, but teachers are about 80% white, middle-class, female, and the student demography, of course, is increasing with diversity. And so what we find is that the research is clear, is that black and brown students, that is, vis-a-vis black students, Latinx students, are referred to the office for what's known as subjective infractions, and white students are referred to the office for what's known as objective infractions. And so what happens is teachers are not aware of these, what might be characterized as implicit biases. And so they're sending students out in a large number, and proportionately, this leads students to missing great opportunities to learn the curriculum.
Last week on Think, I spoke with former Education Secretary John King about the shortage of teachers of color in American schools. Let's listen to that.
It's not just important for students of color to see role models at the front of the classroom. I think it's also important for white students to see diverse role models as well, and diverse folks not only in the classroom but in school leadership roles. We know that today a majority of the kids in our public schools are students of color, but only 18% of our teachers are teachers of color. One of the challenges is that we have a leaky pipeline. Fewer students of color as a percentage are graduating from high school, enrolling in college, graduating from college, graduating with education degrees, choosing teaching. So we've got challenges at every level of the pipeline. But it's a question of investment. Are we willing as a society to invest in the preparation of a quality, diverse teacher workforce?
What does it take, Richard Milner, for schools to recruit more diverse faculties?
Well, I think that we should be mindful, and we should certainly work to increase the teacher of color pipeline. But I think the deeper question is really around how teachers are prepared to support students across different racial and ethnic backgrounds. And so when teachers of color are in the classroom or in education, they may be overburdened They may experience issues of racism. They experience, for sure, and I've found this in my research and others have as well, they experience a higher rate of expectation in terms of working overtime to sort of mentor students and so forth. And so rather than assuming that all teachers of color will have the skills and be prepared to work with students, we've really got to take those deeper questions in mind, which are to ensure that we're recruiting the best and the brightest teachers who are very highly capable of being successful in the classroom and provide mechanisms that support them to be successful.
That's Richard Milner, professor of education at the University of Pittsburgh and director of the Center for Urban Education. We'll talk more with him in a bit, and you can join the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. First, though, let's go back to Craig Cohen of Houston Public Media, joined by Rice University's Linda McNeil. Craig?
Thank you very much, Chris. Linda McNeil is the director of the Center for Education and a professor of education at Rice University. Linda, welcome.
Thank you.
Are we seeing across Texas what Rich Milner just described taking place nationwide, this notion of a sort of resegregation?
Yes. He was very articulate. That was all very important to hear. Our state has incredible diversity, which is an amazing asset, cultural, ethnic, national origin. But at the same time, diversity without equity really is prevents us from having a strong democracy. And the good news is the Texas Constitution does guarantee every one of our children a right to an education. But that right is situated within a history of certainly racial discrimination of all kinds and an anti-tax history. So as I was looking back over sort of historically, where do our current inequities come from? First of all, we had the separate and unequal, and then Brown v. Board came along in 1954. And most of the Texas cities delayed desegregation plans for so long that led to white flight into the suburbs, which just exacerbated both the financial disparities as well as racial disparities. And so once you had any plan in place, those tended to reinforce economic disparities. And we had intra-district discrimination. And then another positive thing, of course, we get court orders, court rulings that say our schools are inadequately funded, unequally funded, which one would think would push legislatures to do something dramatic and make a major investment. But instead, they've either, as you know, been ignored by our legislatures or come up with some kind of patchwork thing. And then I was looking back, many of our policies in the last two decades have been very subtractive from the public schools. Once people got a little more serious about equity, instead of actually equalizing the resources, teacher quality in our schools, they put on a testing system that tested all kids the same way. Well, that took more than $1 billion out of our schools to go to the testing companies.
So, another approach, though, that we've seen in recent years, something like school vouchers or what some characterize today as school choice. What's the Lone Star State's role in the origins of those concepts?
For many legislative sessions over the last two decades, there have been bills proposed to shift our tax dollars into vouchers, whether they were called Liberty Scholarships or some other thing. But basically, that is a shift of tax dollars over to private entities, whether they're church-based or corporate-based, that really have no obligation to our children or to our democratic governance. And the states that have had the longest history, certainly Minneapolis, the city of Milwaukee, and others, now new studies coming out of New Orleans, vouchers not only undermine public schools by taking so many dollars out, they do not have a strong record of educating children well. And the same as the charter chains are another subtractive policy that is really geared at outsourcing our poorest children to people with a corporate interest and a so-called market you know from your neighborhood, shops come and go, stores come and go. And the same with charter, chain charter schools, voucher schools. They come and go depending on the market, not depending on what our communities need.
Briefly, you mentioned state legislatures and how they do or don't approach this or deal with this. We hear a lot about a growing divide between rich and poor. We could probably find that geographic divide of haves and have-nots in nearly any community in Texas. What does this mean for how resources are distributed to schools statewide, and how does this tie into the Robin Hood system of recapture?
Even if you don't know all the technicalities of the Robin Hood plan, which I confess I don't, if you look back historically, it's just one more plan that said, how do we divide up a small pie without raising taxes, even if raising taxes, being smarter about the way we invest our public education dollars, not to outsourcing organizations or testing companies, but in teachers and good curriculum resources. The states that have historically done that and know how to do that, the countries that have done that, Finland's often invoked as really spending the money on instruction. And we haven't done that. And until you think of how many more children we have in the system, and we still haven't replenished the education budgets from the $6 billion that Rick Perry cut when he was governor, and it had devastating consequences, and we now have hundreds of thousands more children, and less than half that money's been restored. So as long, it's very strange in a state as wealthy and as expansive and optimistic as Texas that people have been so small in their thinking about how we invest in our children.
We'll talk more with Linda McNeil from Rice University in Houston in a few minutes. For the moment, let's go back to Chris Boyd in Dallas.
Thanks, Craig. If you would like to join our conversation now, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter at @KERAThink. I would like to ask a quick question of you once again, Rich Milner. When do race-based disadvantages begin to be apparent for U.S. students? This isn't something that crops up in high school. This starts early, right?
Absolutely. What we find is that disparities start to manifest at a very early age. And I agree with Linda in so many points she made. One of the things that we find is that students who are students at a very early age, black students in particular, all students, but we have pretty good science that shows that black students develop what's called a white bias at an early age. And so if you look at the historical work of Mamie and Kenneth Clark, what they found was that when black students were asked about, and these are young children, you're talking about children who are 4 and 5, 6 years old, when they're asked about who the smart child is, or in the doll test, or if those students are asked who the students are who teachers like most, and so forth, those students tended to identify white dolls vis-a-vis as a representation of white bodies and white beings. And so we also know that as students get older, the way they talk about white bias actually decreases. But we're not sure if that white bias actually is a function of decreased bias or if it's a function of their ability to sort of talk and be politically correct. Virtually no practices exist in education, though, that help students inside of school build their racial identity development, although we know from good science that students' sense of racial and ethnic identity influences their outcomes. And this starts very, very early.
All right, let's go to the phones now. We have Pamela calling from Houston. Hi, Pamela.
Hi. With respect to your last point, it's interesting. Little girls as young as 6 identify boys and men as smarter, too, so it's a big problem. My question is as follows. I've been tracking for a very long time the data that's come out indicating that children of color are often inappropriately disciplined and labeled and even find themselves expelled at very young ages. And I cannot liberate any data whatsoever about the ethnicity or race of the teachers who are doing this. given the segregation patterns that seem to be pretty rampant in our schools, is this being visited upon these children by teachers of color?
What do you know about that, Rich? And then we'll have a response from Linda.
Yeah, absolutely. Your point is well taken and well substantiated in the literature. What we know is that more than half of students proportionally who are actually suspended from preschool are kids of color. And so and their teachers, again, tend to be white, female, and middle class. Now, I want to be clear here that the point I'm making here is not that teachers have bad intentions. Teachers tend to work hard. They tend to have a great sort of heart for the work they do, but they tend to be grossly underprepared. And so when you go back to this question of desegregation with Brown in 1954, essentially what we did was we moved bodies around. So we segregated bodies, but we never really got to the core of what it meant and what it means to live and learn with folks who are different than are we from a racial and ethnic background. And so until we centralize and really think seriously about this notion of race, I suspect we're going to continue seeing these patterns.
All right, we're going to hear from Linda and get her follow-up after the break so that we make sure that she has ample time to follow up. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter @KERAThink. My guests for the hour are Richard Milner, professor of education at the University of Pittsburgh and director of the Center for Urban Education, and Linda McNeil, director of the Rice University Center for Education, and of course, my colleague Craig Cohen, who is at Houston Public Media. He is host of Houston Matters. We will resume the conversation in a couple of minutes and hope you'll join us.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd.
And I'm Craig Cohen, host of Houston Matters.
Today, we're partnering up for a special conversation about diversity, opportunity, and Texas schools. Our guests are Rich Milner, professor of education at the University of Pittsburgh and director of the Center for Urban Education, and Linda McNeil of the Rice University Center for Education. You can join the conversation on Twitter. We're @KERAThink.
We're also taking your calls this hour at 800-933-5372, or you can email your questions and comments to think@kera.org.
It's all part of KERA's American Graduate Series, Race, Poverty, and the Changing Face of Schools, which you can find online at kera.org/schools.
Houston Public Media is also taking a year-long look at what being the most diverse city in the nation really means. It's the Diverse City Project, and you can find it at houstonpublicmedia.org/diversity.
Before the break, we heard from Pamela, who raised this question of implicit bias in the way that students of color are disciplined more harshly at times than their white classmates. And Craig, I'm wondering if Linda wanted to follow up on what we heard from Rich about that.
Yeah, Linda, go ahead. You had some thoughts on this.
Well, first of all, the idea of schools as being so punitive has been structurally built in. It's not that teachers are getting less patient or whatever. Many districts, including ours under previous superintendents here in Houston, have had test score goals, have had disciplinary referral goals, and schools have to really adhere to these in very generic ways that are not really about the children. And so if we think about several things. First of all, that intersection of in high poverty schools, which may also in our city, certainly racially diverse, 75% of our children here are designated economically disadvantaged. A child who is coming in from a neighborhood that's not safe, from a family that has food scarcities, from parents that lose jobs or try to have three minimum wage jobs, their attention span is likely to be different. Their capacity to sit still in school, whether they feel school really matters to them. So what may manifest as a discipline problem that gets referred may be something very different from I'm a wiggly kid who's not paying attention. And our schools are really not set up to, in terms of class sizes, the number of children each teacher has, the kinds of services in the schools. So a lot of things get mislabeled as discipline. The other structural problem that really falls harder on poor kids, children of color, has been this very punitive accountability system, started in Texas, magnified under No Child Left Behind, which rate schools and teachers and superintendents on the test scores. And we've done extensive research here in Houston that has shown that if kids are seen as a liability to the test score ratings of the school, if perhaps on practice tests they don't do so well, they are literally triaged out of our high schools and sometimes out of our middle schools. And so whether a disciplinary reason is used or just counseling the parents, you don't want your kid to fail the test, so maybe they shouldn't be here for 11th grade or whatever. We've had structural, really perverse incentives that hopefully are beginning to be addressed. But right now, given the federal context of starting to, at least the claims on healthcare, education are going to be massive, massive cuts for all members of the family. That is just going to impact our children of greatest need even more. So giving more obligation to us locally to figure this out.
Linda, we've been talking, of course, about school-age children, but among the many, many bills in Austin is one to fund full-day pre-K programs, something discussed but not passed last session. Educators stress the value of early childhood education. How does economic opportunity play into that educational opportunity here in Texas?
Right now, there's some wonderful preschools all over the state for children, for parents who can afford them for their children. So we know developmentally those early years are so key. I am not one that thinks we need schools to get all three-year-olds and four-year-olds to read. I think kids should be playing in the dirt and learning music and just learning about themselves and social interactions and just being able to experience the wonder of life and of the world. And we definitely are shortchanging families who want preschool for their children, either because of the parents working or just because of that great enrichment. And sadly, Texas has been very backward about that and missing an opportunity. And even if we have to use the justification of economic growth later and cost savings and prisons or whatever. We shouldn't have to go there. It should be about the kids. But there is every justification for investing in the education and good daycare for our youngest children.
I know we want to take some more calls, so let's send it back to Chris.
Sure. Rich, there are people who believe that the best way to deal with race in public school settings is to ignore it, which is to say, if teachers are trying to treat all students the same, there will be no need to address race. I wonder what your response to that is.
Well, the first thing I would say is that it's really nonsensical to approach our work in that way. What we sort of classify that at in the literature really is this notion of color blindness. And I would sort of, one of the points I would really stress is that we actually should be pressing towards equity and rather than equality. We should be really thinking about being responsive to the situations in ways that are equitable and really rethink this idea of equality. I want to make sure I stress this point that I am not suggesting that students should not be disciplined or that they should not we should not develop disciplinary sort of strengths among our students, right? We want students to be disciplined. But what we are finding in our schools overwhelmingly is that there's a difference between discipline and punishment. And what we know from good science is that suspensions and expulsions just aren't working. And so we continue putting students out of school, and we see very little improvement in terms of student outcomes. And so when we approach our work from this sort of race blind or color blind perspective, we miss really important sort of features of who those students are, who communities are, and really thinking about these communities as assets, you know, as strengths, rather than as liabilities or folks who are somehow incomplete.
All right, let's go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We have Phil calling from Houston. Hi, Phil.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is I guess all of you can comment on it, as I'm sure you have differing perspectives. But for Mr. Milner, I wondered what his thoughts are on with the talk of diversity, equity, when we have a situation here in Texas where we have textbooks that characterize a certain group of people having a choice as far as coming over here and characterize their labor here as immigrant labor. What type or...
Hang on, Phil. You're talking about enslaved workers being described as immigrant workers. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay.
That's correct. In the textbooks that came out like last summer, I believe. So my question is, if we're talking about diversity and our students need to have a positive outlook on themselves in order to be successful, how is it that something like that, so controversial, gets through to the classroom if we all supposedly have this concern for our children?
Melinda, what do you think? Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
Professor Milner, were you finished?
Sure, you feel free to start.
Okay. I looked into this before I came because obviously we want to know everyone's stories. We want to know our community stories, our individual stories, and our collective history, and that the caller is exactly right. This has been so what should be an incredibly rich, just amazing education for our children, having people here from all over the world. So many of those voices are silenced, including, as he said, in that frankly ridiculous history book. But there is positive movement on this. There was a completely phony and very discriminatory and demeaning textbook put forward as Mexican American history last year, and what it did was galvanize researchers, historians, community elders, parents, teachers, not only to fight that book, but now which TEA, the Texas Education Agency, decided absolutely would not be approved. Across all party lines, everybody voted against it. And so the good news is that brought people together to really push the legislature and TEA to actually authorize ethnic studies as a part of the school curriculum, as part of the school budget. And I happen to bring those numbers: House Bill 1817, House Bill 366, and Senate Bill 695. And I have a blog, Educating All Our Children, and I have a posting on there encouraging people to contact their legislators, because we should see all of the people who live here and all the countries they come from as an amazing asset for our education. And the idea that we somehow either ignore those out of ignorance or downplay them for some other reason is just a ridiculous missed opportunity.
All right, Richard Milner, I know that you likely want to weigh in on this.
Sure. Well, one of the things that I would add here is that there is a difference between the curriculum and instruction, right? So there are some overlap, but the curriculum is what we teach. And so so much of what can be disrupted and interpreted really has to do with the teacher's ability instructionally to help students engage the curriculum And you know, so regardless of the text or regardless of the curriculum that students are engaging, teachers have to be prepared to help students read critically, to engage, to analyze what they are reading in ways such that they would never accept some nonsense like, you know, immigrants being sort of glorified or romanticized, or slaves being misrepresented as immigrants and so forth. And so I think we've got to really get back to the core of helping teachers. And this is why teacher development is so important. You know, we've got to help teachers gain the capacity to be able to disrupt, pose the kinds of questions to get students into a place where they are able to engage a text, whether they're in the classroom or elsewhere, critically.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. To wrap up here very briefly with both of our guests, and we'll start with you, Rich, how can parents best advocate for their students, whether in a school that looks very segregated or a school that is quite diverse?
I think one of the things parents have to do is really think about and plan strategically, not only individually about what matters for them as individuals, but to really think about the community, galvanize colleagues and other parents in the community to really sort of push teachers on a more localized level, both in their local schools, but also think about strategic moves that the district and the state should tackle. I think being very organized around what those big themes and issues are will only allow us to propel the work for it. And I think it, in general, providing parents with voice and providing parents with opportunities to actually speak from the vantage points of their own cultural experiences as well as those of the community benefit us. You know, I'll sort of conclude with this point, and that is, you know, until we move forward with sort of past this notion that we're only looking individually at our own children, we're going to find ourselves in a holding pattern. This work is about justice, and it's about meeting the needs of every child.
I'm going to have to jump in. Great points, but we are now out of time. Richard Milner is professor of education at the University of Pittsburgh and director of the Center for Urban Education. We also heard from Linda McNeil, director of the Rice University Center for Education. Wonderful to have you both with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Thanks also to the Houston Matters team, which includes Craig Cohen, Michael Haggerty, Maggie Martin, Josh Zinn, Abner Fletcher, Tom Carter, and Adele Howlin. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. Subscribe to our podcast and find out about upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.